Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Jeremy Nichols. He's the Climate and Energy Program Director for Wild Earth Guardians and has been active in environmental protection efforts in the American West for over 15 years. So thank you so much for being on today, Jeremy.
Yeah, thanks, Derek.
So what I'd like to talk about today is fracking, and specifically fracking on public lands in the West. So can you give people an overview first on fracking and then on fracking on public lands in the West?
Well, I'll start with fracking. I mean, fracking is a general term that we apply to pretty much all stages of oil and gas development. It's almost economically impossible for the oil and gas industry to drill an oil and gas well to produce oil or gas without having to do some kind of fracking. And by fracking, we basically mean stimulation, some artificial stimulation, which usually involves dropping explosives down a well bore hole and then pumping chemicals under high pressure to stimulate the flow of oil and gas to the surface. So that's kind of fracking in a nutshell, but it's not just that one step of the process. We're talking about the impacts of the landscape that occur when they're clearing the way for drilling pads and drilling rigs to set up. We're talking about the actual rig operation, the fracking operations, the production that happens afterward, and of course all the waste disposal that that sometimes does and sometimes does not happen effectively. And in the American West, you know, when we talk about fracking, I mean, it's been a big issue in California these days, but really the epicenter of fracking has been and continues to be the Rocky Mountain West. And if you look down the spine of the Rocky Mountains from Montana all the way down to southern New Mexico and southern Arizona, basically on both sides of that spine is where oil and gas occurs and where oil and gas has been tapped for many years, but where it's being tapped more than ever before today, given our technological advancements and, of course, the economic incentive for the oil and gas industry to just ravage the landscape for every last drop of oil and gas.
So I mentioned in an email to you that I grew up in Colorado and spent a lot of time as a child and teen and in my early 20s in the wild. And so I know, or knew, I guess is the key word, knew Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico pretty well. And
yeah.
I have this goes up through the 80s, and I know people who live in all of those states who have told me that the landscape that I knew at that point has been transformed by oil and gas operations on a scale that would be virtually unimaginable. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, the scale of industrialization, when you look at the impact of oil and gas drilling and fracking to public lands, is almost unimaginable. It's hard to explain just the scale of it. You look at an area like the Uinta Basin of Northeast Utah. It's a lowland region that extends from the southern flanks of the Uinta Mountains, the High Uintas, which if you're ever in that area, you cannot miss them. They're classic high mountain Rockies. Extends south to an area called the Book Cliffs, another iconic uplift in central Utah that if you've ever driven along I-70, you're there, you see it, and they're amazing. Pretty much that whole area has been drilled. It's been turned into a carpet of wells and roads accessing those wells, and it's basically a huge fossil fuel factory. When we talk about oil and gas, people a lot of times think of a single rig, a single well. When we look at oil and gas in the West, we see basically giant factories covering tens of thousands of square miles of landscape. And yes, there is undeveloped land in between the wells, but what the industry has effectively done is drilled so densely in these areas that they've effectively, well, they've destroyed all wildness that was once there, but they've effectively fragmented habitat. They've effectively transformed what was once undeveloped open public lands into their own oil and gas production process. And we see this has happened in western Wyoming, an area called the Upper Green River Basin. It is where the Green River starts from the Wind River Range up in northwest Wyoming. We've seen it in the Powder River Basin in northeast Wyoming, just massive, an extensive amount of oil and gas drilling that has occurred there over the years. You name the iconic landscape in the American West, and oil and gas has either impacted it or is right at its doorstep, threatening to convert it from an undeveloped landscape to another fossil fuel factory.
You know, you mentioned northeastern Wyoming, and then I've got friends who live down by Carlsbad, and they will tell the same story. The point being that we have the two ends of that region are both affected. It's not just Wyoming, not just northeastern Utah. And can you give an idea of when you say that they're sort of, I don't know if you used the word carpeted, but I think you did. So what would be a typical, I mean, are the wells, would they be, I know it's going to be all different, but would they be 2 feet apart, or would they be 2 miles apart, or would they be 20 miles apart? How far would be in a field at play, as it were, what might be a typical distance between rigs?
Boy, you know, it varies. It runs the gamut. It used to be that it was typically one well per 640 acres. That's a square mile. Over the years, they've dropped it down to one well per 40 acres, and in some cases, one well per 10 acres. But now what they're able to do is drill multiple wells from single pads. And so they've been able to reduce the density, but in turn, they've had to drill much bigger well pads. And so it runs the, you know, we see all kinds of development. And I think the take home message there is that it seems like industry, they're good at filling up every last square inch to get every last drop out of the ground. And especially nowadays, when the name of the game seems more about volume, it's not about just making a steady living. It's about punching as many wells in the ground as possible, as quickly as possible, to produce as much as possible, as quickly as possible. And that seems to be the name of the game. And in some cases, you know, they can get away with drilling in a, you know, in a less dense fashion. In some areas, we still do see wells, one well per 640 acres. But increasingly, to be competitive and to make the money and meet their bottom line, you know, these companies are really going to desperate measures to, like I said, tap every last square inch. And it's, you know, some forms, you know, like the shale gas drilling, shale gas and oil drilling, and this is a big buzzword now too, and rightfully so. Shale is typically considered to not be a producing geologic formation. It's usually where the oil comes from, and then it seeps into surrounding sandstone layers. But industry found a way to bust the hell out of shale through fracking and produce from these formations. And so it's opened up a whole new frontier of drilling, but it's also required industry to step up the density of its development and just the energy intensiveness of its development. We're looking at operations now where with conventional, you know, tapping of sandstone formations, it might've been, you know, a small well every 40 acres. And now we're looking at like towering rigs with dozens of wells on a single landscape and having these things pop up every 40 acres. It's really stunning to see the shift.
So I just want to point out that even if we're talking one well for every 640 acres, that is still a pretty incredible density. And if you start talking one every 40 acres, then it's just like you said, it's basically a factory. You don't have, well, so let's, instead of just asserting that, let's talk about some of the effects of these processes on both the natural communities as a whole and on some specific creatures or plants. Because I can't imagine that this would make pronghorn antelope or sage grouse or anybody else very happy.
Yeah, although industry likes to get their pictures of the pronghorn next to the oil well out in the middle of Wyoming. But you know, belying that picture is the, you know, a very sad truth that once you cover the landscape in such an intensive form of development, you are wringing the life out of this landscape. You are reducing the availability of forage for deer and pronghorn. You are making it more dangerous for deer and pronghorn to live out there. They have more roads that they have to deal with. They have, you know, more noise, and just more human presence that, you know, they may be tolerant of some human presence, but not the kind of industrial presence that is cropping up in these areas. I mean, let's think of a refinery in a big city. I mean, what kind of wildlife do you see near a refinery? Not a lot, unfortunately. And, you know, when you look at oil and gas, the process of producing oil and gas on Western public lands, they're basically a bunch of little mini refineries in sometimes a very small space, relatively small space. And so you see the same, you know, aversion to these developments. And sage grouse, I think, are probably one of the most important indicators of how harmful this development is. You know, every study they do on sage grouse behavior finds that time and time again, that the closer oil and gas rigs get to their nesting sites, the more likely they are to abandon and never use those sites again. And of course, if sage grouse aren't using their traditional nesting sites, they're going to go away. They don't just find other places. They can't just pick up and fly south to Argentina, like other, other birds might be able to. They can do some flying, but not that much. And so really these birds are, I mean, canary in a coal mine is a very overused, term, but it's totally appropriate for the sage grouse in the face of oil and gas development. But one thing I really want to make clear is that, you know, it is the land that's being impacted, being devastated in many cases, but the impacts go from, you know, the very bottoms of the rivers in these regions to the very tops of the mountains that adjoin, these oil and gas producing basins. The air pollution from oil and gas is pushing smog levels in areas like Western Wyoming and Northeast Utah to higher than what Los Angeles experiences.
Wait, can you,
it's a real
can,
health concern for human communities. Yeah.
Okay. The phone crapped out for a minute. Can you say your last three sentences again, please?
Yeah. Yeah. So what I was referring to is just the impacts of oil and gas development being yes, the direct impacts to the landscape, but really the impacts extend, you know, from the bottoms of the streams in these areas to the very tips of the mountains, very tops of the mountains that adjoin these oil and gas producing regions. And, you know, what we're seeing, kind of what really underscores these far-reaching impacts more than anything has been the air pollution impacts associated with oil and gas development on public lands here in the West. We're seeing areas like Western Wyoming and Northeast Utah that have just been hammered by the oil and gas industry experience smog levels higher than Los Angeles. Just phenomenally high smog levels. And yes, while there's concern for the human communities there, you know, ozone, ground level ozone, which is a key ingredient of smog, is poisonous to plants too. And it degrades ecosystems. It's a very significant threat to the, you know, the integrity of these seemingly, very resistant high mountain, high plains ecosystems, but really very fragile, high plains ecosystems. And, you know, adding this pollution into the mix on top of all the landscape impacts, the impacts, I mean, it's just thoroughly devastating. And like I said, they're far reaching and you can't look at just where that well is or where that road is. You have to look far beyond there to really grasp the full impacts of this development.
You know, like I said before, I grew up in the region and, I feel a little bit awkward saying this, but of those states, I think in some ways, Wyoming was in many ways my least favorite place to be because it was, it seemed so hot in the summer and so cold in the winter. But I'm saying all this in terms of, excuse me, one of the things that Wyoming had going for it completely was incredibly clean air.
Yeah.
And it was just, and another thing it had going for it was silence. That I remember, and this is true in Nevada too, that I remember a couple times when I was younger, just standing out in the middle of a big open space, and I had a pocket watch that, and I put it on the ground, and I walked 10 or 11 steps away, and I could still hear it ticking, because it was so, so quiet. And I could hear, you know, there were cattle around, and I could hear the cattle literally a couple, 3 miles away. And it's just, I don't. So, can you talk a little bit about the noise effects? Because that has to be pretty devastating to whomever does not like industrial noise.
Yeah, I mean it's part and parcel with these far-reaching impacts. I mean, you at every step of the way, there's heavy machinery involved in the process of bringing oil and gas up from the ground. You know, at the drilling stage, it's probably the most intensive, but to get the gas into pipelines, you have to run giant compressor engines. These are basically giant engines that are running full bore 24/7 to keep gas lines pressurized and to keep gas flowing to wherever. And then, you know, these wells are constantly maintained. There's constantly truck traffic coming in and out of these areas. And yeah, you're exactly right, Derek. I mean, Wyoming, that's the least populated state in the country. It has massively wide open spaces. I know Montana's called the Big Sky State, but I respectfully have to challenge that. I actually think Wyoming might be the real Big Sky State in terms of the openness that's there and kind of the solitude and quietness that goes along with that. I mean, you really get the full experience there. But it is increasingly a rare experience because of this noise. And on calm days, yeah, I mean, you can hear this industrial development from miles and miles away. And there is no respite. There's no respite at all for people who visit this landscape. Or for the life that resides there. And, you know, go ahead.
I've heard some interviews of ranchers in Wyoming who have complained very bitterly about both the loss of silence and also the loss of the very sweet-smelling air that basically they're now saying that their homes stink.
Yeah. It's an oft-repeated complaint, and you know, I think it's a really sad testament to how far we have let this destruction go. And, you know, industry likes to write it off as aesthetics. Oh, you just don't like, you know, what's a bad smell to you? Who cares? Or what's a beautiful vista? What's a beautiful landscape to you? Who cares? We need this stuff. I mean, this is stuff, though, that is so critical to, I think, that the health of that, well, the health of the earth for one thing, but the health of the human existence. It's you know, it helps us understand kind of our primeval nature and our origins, and helps us, I think, connect with the natural world in ways that most people never have a chance to. And we're so lucky here in the West to have the opportunity to experience this. And so for industry to just dismiss it so flippantly like that as just aesthetics, it's incredibly offensive. And what ranchers in Wyoming are conveying isn't just a bad smell every now and then. It is a human experience and a life experience that has monumentally shifted. And you know, things are never going to be the same, and they know that. And so there's great concern.
Yeah, I want to say one more thing about smell, and then I want to go to some sheer numbers that about the smell. I live in rainforest in Northern California, and you know, I honestly never, for the most part, I don't notice the smell here. But then anytime I go on tour or anything else, I go to a city, when I come back, I cannot believe how much I love the smell of the forest. And if I'm just validating what you just said about it being, I mean, if instead this smelled like a refinery, I would want to move. I mean,
yeah.
And this is as a human, and I just want to, you know, I don't see any reason to think that non-humans, especially, I mean, for crying out loud, bears, for example, have senses of smell. Oh gosh, what are the numbers? I think that dogs are supposed to be like, I'm making up the numbers, but like 30 or 100 times stronger sense of smell than humans, and bears are supposed to be 30 or 100 times stronger than dogs.
Yeah.
So can you imagine for a non-human whose life depends on smell, and your sense of smell is unimaginably acute, what torture it would be to be forced to smell industrial? I mean, I don't know how to describe it, but I do know the smell of driving through the parts of Denver where there are refineries. I mean, I know what that smells like.
Yeah.
And to have that, but for it to be magnified by literally several thousand times would be torture.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And every single well has that type of smell associated with it. It's and it is just like being next to a refinery. It's maybe not be, it may not be as massive, but it's equally impacting.
So when you sent me something this morning that, I'm wondering if you can just go through a little bit of the list, because the numbers, or if you don't have it in front of you, I can do it or whatever, but you sent me a map that has, various circles on it, with comments like Pawnee National Grassland, 1,400 wells approval in 2015. Converse County Shale, 5,000 wells approval in 2015. So we're not talking six wells. We're not talking 15 wells. We're talking 14,248 wells, Buffalo Field Office approval in 2014. That's a hell of a lot of wells.
Yeah. Yeah. What we tried to lay out are the major oil and gas drilling and fracking proposals that actually the U.S. Interior Department, so the federal government, is considering approving right now. And there's a fair number that are on the table for 2014 and 2015. And yeah, you're exactly right, Derek. I mean, we're not talking about a well here and a well there. These are massive, massive fossil fuel proposals that industry is pushing hard for. And the Obama administration seems very willing to accommodate. And, you know, you pointed out just a few in Wyoming, 14,248 wells in the Buffalo Field Office of Northeast Wyoming. But it runs up and down the spine of the Rockies, as I mentioned. I mean, all the way down to New Mexico, where a new proposal by the BLM to let industry tap a formation called the Mancos Shale will lead to the development of untold thousands of wells. We don't even have a firm estimate at this point, but we are hearing in the tens of thousands. You know, we've experienced a lot of devastation so far. I mean, the area where the Mancos Shale is, the San Juan Basin, it's where Chaco Canyon is located. It's really a cultural treasure of the Southwest. And already in that area, it's called the Farmington Field Office, that's managed by the Bureau of Land Management, which is the Interior Department agency that manages both public lands, most of public lands in the American West, and also all the federal minerals. They've approved well over 20,000 oil and gas wells over the past few years in this area. And now they're proposing to allow even more because industry, as I said, they're wanting to push as quickly as possible to develop as much as possible. And the Mancos Shale is the next target. So all these proposals, and you pointed out the circles that we drew, and it's literally New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, Montana, where we're seeing just massive drilling and fracking proposals come to the forefront. We're under siege here in the West. And you know, our public lands are right in the middle of it all. Which is, you know, I think a lot of people in America, I think they'd be shocked if they knew about this. It's a bit frustrating though on our end, you know, in the West where we kind of grew up with public lands and we learned to love them and they're there and we appreciate them. But you have to understand a lot of the country doesn't understand public lands and doesn't appreciate them to the same degree that we might. And so our struggle right now is not only to try to confront these proposals and to expose the hypocrisy of the Obama administration and signing off on these costs, the costs associated with this oil and gas drilling and fracking, but to help America understand what's at risk here. I mean, these public lands, they're not just Colorado's, they're not just Wyoming's, they're every American's. They're the world's, frankly. Everybody can come here and enjoy them and you know, experience them, you know, in all their glory. And, you know, if we can't get every American concerned about what's happening here, then we're going to be in trouble. And it's not just going to be the West that loses out. It's going to be this entire country, because these landscapes, these are, you know, I don't want to wax patriotic because, like I said, these are the world's lands. But at the same time, I mean, the Grand Canyon, it defines America. And, you know, it defines like our pride in our natural world in this country. You know, pride that I think is still there in many people, even on the East Coast and even in the Midwest. But sometimes, you know, we need to help them understand what could really be lost here. And, you know, the Grand Canyon is a great example. It may not be directly drilled, but the air pollution, that area could experience in the face of all this oil and gas development could devastate the views, devastate the scenery there, devastate the experience that people value so much in this region.
So I think everything you're saying is great, and I'm wondering if we can. There's a couple directions I'd like to go. First, I would like to go back to what you said about Obama's hypocrisy, and to if you can talk for a minute about the dissonance between his global warming rhetoric and his fracking reality.
Yeah.
And so I guess if you can go there, and then we'll either go a different direction or I'll come back to something else in a second.
I'm down for anything there. I mean, this is the thing. The blunt truth of the matter is he genuinely believes, and his administration seems to be you know, expressing this, that more oil and gas development is somehow the key to solving global warming. And the logic being that if we can incentivize more oil and gas development, that it will undermine coal. And it's a very crabbed equation. It's basically if we promote something that's less bad than coal, we'll be in a better situation. When in fact, if we could promote something that's even better than fossil fuels, we'd be in a great situation. We would actually overcome global warming in its entirety and actually confront the real costs of fossil fuel development, which, you know, we're experiencing firsthand in the West. It's recklessly hypocritical. And I think that that's putting it very mildly, to say that, oil and gas, that the costs of oil and gas are somehow acceptable or worse, necessary to confront global warming. I mean, it's like, you know, a farmer dealing with, lost crops by sacrificing his children. When in fact, a farmer could just find a better way to grow food and find, better crops to grow. You know, it's the wrong choice here. And that's the worst of it all, is that this isn't the choice. It's not a choice of either coal or natural gas, or oil. We actually have other choices. We have, energy conservation, energy efficiency. We have rooftop solar, for Christ's sake. You know, what we don't have though are the policies that, are really advancing, those ways of confronting carbon pollution and transitioning away from fossil fuels. So, it's a very disturbing political play. And, you know, we keep hearing this rhetoric about all of the above, and it unfortunately seems to be all of the above at any cost. And so President Obama, as he is signaling his desire to confront carbon, and we appreciate that. I mean, how refreshing is it to have a president that is actually recognizing global warming and the need to confront carbon? But it's incredibly dangerous that he's now saying that, the West should just accept this loss of public lands, this loss of clean air, this loss of clean water, this loss of wildlife to meet this crabbed energy vision. So it's like I said, recklessly hypocritical, and the West is just, I think, case in point about how the costs associated with oil and gas are simply not worth it in the end.
Well, thank you for that. And I guess there's a couple things I wanted to say about the I want to go back to the whole public lands aspects. And one thing is more personal, and then another is more political. And the personal thing is, you know, one of the places you said there's 1,400 wells cited for approval in Pawnee National Grasslands, and that actually was a very special place to me when I was growing up. We went out there quite a bit, and out to Pawnee Buttes, and I mean, that was where the first time in my life I ever got dive bombed by a golden eagle.
No kidding.
Yeah, I accidentally got too close to her nest, and she was not very happy about it. And it was, you know, I was like 8 years old, and I mean, that was something I will never forget. And,
yeah, how amazing.
It was out, I mean, to get there, you had to drive a long ways on very small roads. And, there was, myself, my friend, my mom, and her friend were the only human beings within, you know, who knows how far. And I can't imagine that area being despoiled with a ton of wells, a ton of roads, everything else. So that's on the personal level. And then on the larger level, I'm gonna ask a question for which I actually don't have any idea the answer. I know that public lands grazing is heavily subsidized by the American public, and timber sales are a huge corporate subsidy. And I'm presuming from this that, and mining, I mean, for crying out loud, public lands mining is a dreadful bit of corporate welfare. So I'm presuming that even leaving off the environmental costs, et cetera, are these also your basic standard corporate giveaways in terms of how much they pay for fees?
Yeah, I mean, it is. Is it as bad as like hard rock mining under the 1872 mining law? Not quite, but yeah, the amount of money they pay for the privilege to permanently take oil and gas from the ground and sell it and profit from it, it is pennies on the dollar. This is an irreplaceable resource. And, the royalty rates that they pay are lower than most states, what most states assess. Interestingly, the government actually collects more royalties from offshore oil and gas drilling than they do onshore. So all the stuff going on in the Rockies, industry is paying less on like a per production basis than people offshore are paying. So there's these discrepancies where, oil and gas is not being assessed. I think a fair amount of revenue that the American public deserves right now in the face of the privilege of being able to profit from these public resources. But I think that it's a perpetual problem with the industrialization of our public lands. Our federal government, unfortunately, although many government officials take seriously their position as stewards of our public lands, are conflicted. They're conflicted because, for example, with the Bureau of Land Management, while they're tasked with recovering or with protecting public lands and protecting wildlife and clean water and clean air, they're also charged by our Congress and by our president to recover money and to go get money from selling oil and gas. And, it is the worst case of the fox guarding the hen house. And it's not talked about much. It was interesting after the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf. The former Secretary of the Interior, Ken Salazar, went to work and severed the Minerals Management Service, which is the federal agency charged with overseeing offshore oil and gas development. And he wanted to separate the revenue collection arm from the resource protection arm. And yet the BLM came away from all that unscathed, and they are still one beast. They collect revenue, and they're supposed to protect resources. But guess who wins at the end of the day? It's the people bringing in the money, and the people bringing in the money trump resource protection time and time again. And that's a really dangerous situation that we're in, notwithstanding this administration's hypocrisy on fossil fuels and on climate change. We have a broken public lands management agency, and I think, all the little subsidizing issues aside, just the principle of the matter is, I think, the most disturbing aspect of this.
My experience, I have no experience with attempting to stop fracking on public lands. My experience was a little bit with grazing and then primarily with trying to stop timber sales. And my experience of the Forest Service and the BLM was that their mantra was always get out the cut. And I'm presuming that's applicable to this too, in terms of getting out the gas, or drill baby drill is a phrase I keep thinking as we talk about this, that, the ghost of Sarah Palin is still here.
Yeah, she's very much alive and well here in the Rockies. Yeah, that's exactly right, Derek. And I think that's a great analogy there, because I myself cut my teeth on environmental activism, filing timber sale appeals, and we actually won a few every now and then. It seemed like, in hindsight, like, wow, that was kind of easy. But with oil and gas, it is the same mentality. It's the same get the cut out. But the challenge is unlike anything I think we've ever experienced. I mean, we're talking about industries that that are way more powerful than the timber industry, have way more money. And way more political influence, it seems. But at the same time, I mean, we have a movement that's becoming more galvanized than ever before around fighting this type of development. It's not to say that we're in the clear yet, but I'm hopeful that just as people saw the insanity around the overlogging of national forests, or just the logging of national forests, an old growth habitat, that people are coming around to realizing that this is, it's the same beast. It just happens to be we're in 2014 now and not in the late 1990s, early 2000s. And so I hope people kind of take, their history, their memory around some of the past public lands fights that have been front and center, like logging, and realize that, okay, we're in a new day of age. We have this fossil fuel onslaught. Let's take that memory and let's take the experiences and insight that we learned from those fights and apply it here. Because if we can't bring it together, if we can't get it together around combating this kind of development, you can see, I mean, you mentioned this map and the projects that are on the table right now. The scale of destruction is just, it's almost unimaginable what we stand to lose. And that's just the on-the-ground impacts. We're not even talking about all the carbon that is going to be unleashed, both from the direct development of this oil and gas and also from the combustion of this oil and gas. I mean, oil and gas is produced for one primary reason, and it's just to be burned. And, you know, we don't live in a day of age where we can afford to be burning anything anymore.
I want to go back to what you were saying about this sort of split or the broken administrative system, and mention something that I've experienced where I live now, in, like I said, far northern California. The local national forest is a little bit different, or actually it's a lot different than my experience of national forests anywhere else I've ever lived, because I kept wondering why the local national forest keeps doing all these great things. And then it's like, because I'm so unused to that. I'm used to just timber industry and national forest being, you know, them working together, Forest Service working together. But then I realized, or somebody told me, that the thing is that the Six Rivers National Forest, which is local, has no commercial timber sale program. And the point I'm trying to make is just to validate what you were saying about when they have the split program, or when they have the split motivations or split mandates, that they're supposed to A, protect the land, and B, make money through timber sales or selling oil and gas leases or whatever, that they, that the money wins. And I'm just validating that, in that Six Rivers is actually really cool and they do a lot of really good things.
Yeah, wow.
And it took me a couple years to realize why, and then it's because they don't have a commercial timber sale program.
How about that?
So I want to talk, we have like 7 or 8 minutes left.
Uh-huh.
I want to talk about what happens. Okay. Historically, at least in my experience, a lot of the central what happens in timber sales is that the profits are privatized and the costs are externalized, which is of course the story of capitalism. Mm-hmm. And so when a timber sale is done, usually my experience is that it's left up to the public to deal with the mess. And so when what happens? How much are the when they finish with these, how bad are things afterwards? Is there, and I know, and don't get me wrong, I mean, you know my work and you know that I think that a lot of this stuff can never be cleaned up, but how decent are they in their attempts to clean up when they're done?
Well, I mean, from a practical standpoint, I mean, I've traipsed all around like the deserts of central Wyoming, actually inventorying potential wilderness areas, which was quite the experience I had about 10 years ago. And, you know, there were roads, there were well pads, there were seismograph lines. You know, companies lay out these lines and they send seismic waves into the ground to find the oil and gas. There were signs of that development from the 1940s, 50s, and 60s still very much apparent on the landscape. It never really went away, especially in a high desert landscape like that where, you know, regeneration is just, it's a very hard living. It's beautiful in that sense. It's very rugged and it makes you greatly appreciate the life that's managed to persist there. But it'll be decades longer before things get fully restored. I mean, for crying out loud, the Oregon Trail goes through that area. Just wagons that went through and you can still see the ruts. So not surprisingly, when somebody takes a bulldozer out to those landscapes, it leaves a scar. But, you know, I think another dimension of that is we're seeing now well sites where industry, they went in like in the 1940s and they tapped one formation, and then they came in the 1960s and they figured out a way to tap another formation, and then the 1980s they've tapped another formation, and now today they're going into shale formations. Industry is really good about squeezing every last drop out of the formations, the geologic formations that they're tapping, and we're talking thousands and thousands of feet of rock and different kinds of rock that they're finding ways to get oil and gas out of. And so in some cases, I think, you know, restoration It won't be within our lifetime for sure. It may not be within our kids' lifetimes. It may not be within their kids' lifetimes. We're talking about a perpetual fossil fuel production process, and that's deeply disturbing, and really I think raises the stakes even more that you know, as industry gets its foot in the door, it's not going away anytime soon. And so even though, you know, restoration may happen over several decades, you know, we're not on a path right now where that's even a guarantee. And as we see another, you know, in some parts of the West, I mean, what is today's oil and gas field is tomorrow's coal mine, or you know, tomorrow's uranium mine. Every time, again, industry gets its foot in the door, everybody lines up to try to reap some kind of profit. And so it's really, it's a dangerous time that we're in right now. And, you know, what's to come will really, really set the tone for what we have to deal with for probably centuries to come. And, you know, and that's not even considering the climate ramifications.
Right.
So
I think I would like to ask, two more questions. One of them is, or three more questions. The first question is, I'm wondering if you can just, give a list of some of the names of the plants or animals. I think kind of like the Vietnam War Memorial or other memorials where people, I find that sometimes very powerful. Can you just tell the listeners the names of some of the wild beings who are harmed by public lands fracking in the West, of 10 or 15 of them or 20 or however many you want to do?
Oh boy, you're putting me on the spot there. Well, I mean, sage grouse you mentioned earlier. I mean, it's just, you know, like I said, like the key indicator of what's going on here. There's also its cousin, the greater or the Gunnison sage grouse in western Colorado. You know, it's its own species that exists only in a handful of areas in western Colorado and southeast Utah. It's also in the way of a lot of new fracking plans in that part of the West. There's white-tailed prairie dogs. They used to be ubiquitous in the Rockies, and they've declined significantly over the years. And oil and gas development has fragmented its habitat, turned colonies into, you know, basically death camps. We're talking about ferruginous hawks that, you know, are being increasingly impacted by the noise and just general disturbance of oil and gas development. These are the biggest raptors out on our deserts and grasslands. There's golden eagles that you mentioned. Golden eagles are very sensitive to development, and you know they like to be in very remote locations, and they get very defensive if you encroach. But whereas they could dive bomb you and keep you away, they can't really do that with an oil and gas rig, unfortunately. You know, there's also you know, endangered fish, like in the upper Colorado River drainage, the Colorado pike minnow, the razorback sucker, and the humpback chub, and the bony-tailed chub. These are not the most charismatic fish in the world, but they are keystone species in the Colorado River, upper Colorado River ecosystem. And, you know, they really sustain that aquatic ecosystem, and they're just getting pummeled by contamination that's flowing into these streams. There's plants. There's a rare penstemon species in western Colorado and eastern Utah that, you know, they're dependent on very specific soils, and they can't survive anywhere else. Usually those are very shaley soils, and they're, you know, right where the oil and gas industry wants to plop its well pads and run its operations. And, you know, once these plants go away, they don't have anywhere to go, as I, just like the sage grouse. And they have no refuge. They're in their refuge right now, and that refuge is being destroyed. You think about every species impacted by climate change. I mean, I don't want to be overwhelming, but it's like, you know, yes, we have the species that are right in the way. They're right up front, and they're going to get trampled. But, you know, everything behind those species, you know, all the way up to the yellow-bellied marmot, you know, stands to lose a lot.
Well, or you mentioned the prairie dogs. And once you mention prairie dogs, then, of course, you have to mention rattlesnakes, and you have to mention burrowing owls and everybody else who's related to them, kit foxes, I'm guessing. I don't know,
yep.
but and so, you know, any one of those are like, there's the penstemon. Like I learned years and years ago about there was a species went extinct with the passenger pigeons. It was a passenger pigeon louse. It was a louse that lived only on the feathers of passenger pigeons. And so there is somebody who presumably eats penstemon, that specific
yeah.
species of penstemon. And
yeah.
So there's going to be this ramification. So, okay, the last two questions are, my last question is going to be, what can people do? So before that, are there any questions you really wanted me to ask that I haven't, is there something you want to say that I haven't asked you the question for?
No, I think we've covered a lot of good ground.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
So the last question is, what would you mentioned before this sort of upswelling of resistance against this public lands fracking in the West. And so two questions they're related. One is for people in the West, in the affected areas who listen to this interview, what would you like for them to do? And then the other is, what would you like for people who are not in the affected areas to do?
I mean, for people in the affected areas, you know, I would say, you know, understand what's happening here. That yes, you may see one or two wells, but there's a flood, and you're in the midst of a flood, and that flood, the waters are just going to keep rising. You've got to get engaged, and you've got to overcome the fear of speaking out. You've got to start speaking out, and we're seeing this even in parts of Wyoming. You know, near the town of Douglas, Wyoming, which is between Cheyenne and Casper on I-25, a very small town. You know, mainly a ranching community, but the industry has come in. They started to encroach on this town. It's massive shale oil drilling, and there's heinous flaring going on. And residents are starting to speak out, and they're speaking out very vocally. And it's shaking the political establishment in Wyoming, because Wyoming is used to people just going along with this, and with industry getting everything at once. But the fact that people are starting to speak out is really shifting the debate, and hopefully shifting, you know, whether we win on this. And I would say that's been the most important thing, you know, time and time again, people speaking out, people finding other people who are speaking out and joining forces and joining forces with groups that may be able to bring resources to file lawsuits, for example, to engage politically in Washington, D.C., which I know, you know, you turn your nose up on that. But the fact is, decisions are being made in D.C. that affect our lives. And so it does behoove us to at least understand where we might be able to shift things and find ways to become empowered, whether it's writing letters, whether it's mobilizing and organizing your neighbors, or whether it's joining groups that can bring more resources to bear. You know, just get engaged. And for people outside of the West, I think that was the second part to your question,
yep,
right?
Yep.
You know, understand that this is a national issue. It's maybe going on in Wyoming, but these are your public lands, and it's your federal government that is allowing this to happen to your public lands. You know, for all the people that are concerned about fracking in California, because of the impacts to their backyards, that's a valid concern, and good for them for speaking up and standing up to that. But they have to understand that fracking in the Rocky Mountain West is just as much about affecting their backyard as it is in California, because the West is America's backyard in many ways. It's a metaphorical backyard, if you will, but it's equally worth protecting. And so what we're trying to tell people is that they need to understand this. This is an issue for New Yorkers, for North Carolinians, for Californians, and for Texans even. And I understand they have their own fracking fights, but these are all one and the same, and we need to unite and not just focus on what's directly in front of us or what's directly in our backyard. We need to understand this is a national issue, and we need a national movement.
Well, thank you so much, Jeremy, for being on the show today. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Jeremy Nichols. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.